This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
We will lead off in a strategically important African nation, a nation with a major problem with Islamist terrorism, one in which Europe is deeply interested and has a significant military presence, and that is Mali. Well, this week in this nation, a coup d'etat. To learn about this, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, on Tuesday, soldiers captured Mali's president, and then just a few hours later, he announced his resignation. He said, "I want no blood to be spilled to keep me in power." So Mali has just gone through a coup. The military has taken over. The old leadership has been pushed out. Now, you have a couple of big trends that kind of led up to this in Mali. You've got this terrorist insurgency in the north. Mali has probably, definitely North Africa's biggest jihadi problem right now, at least outside of possibly Libya. But one of the world's biggest jihadi problems. Northern Mali has become one of these kind of ungoverned spaces where terrorists can have free reign. So they had that going on. Then at the same time, you've had a lot of social unrest within Mali. They've had big protests since June. The government's been accused of corruption and mismanagement and this kind of thing. The military has been unhappy. They kind of feel like they're involved in this long war with the terrorists, that lots of them are dying. They're unhappy about pay. They're unhappy about how the war is being managed and the government throwing lives away. So they came in there, they took out the government, and then there's this now waiting and seeing exactly what's going to happen. They've said that they're going to put in place a transitional council to kind of hand power back to the people. The protesters, I think, are cautiously optimistic at the moment that this new government is going to give them what they want and bring about a kind of democratic change in Mali. But right now, it's the military that's in command.
So how does this look to Europe? Maybe you could just talk a bit about Europe's presence in this country, why it's so invested here, and how this factors into its larger strategy, and then how that is affected by what's happening here.
Yeah, Europe's presence in this area is huge. So firstly, Mali is a former French colony, and France just about always, especially in this part of Africa, maintained strong links politically and militarily with its former colonies. So it's got a strong military presence there. When, if you think back several years, when terrorists were overrunning Mali, the French kind of took the lead in stepping forwards and beating those back. At the same time, Mali is critical for Germany. This is Germany's number one overseas deployment. They've got well over 1,000 soldiers in Mali. Mali is the location of the United Nations' most dangerous mission, the mission fighting the terrorists there. And Germany is one of the lead, if not the lead nation, doing that. And then Germany is also the lead nation in an EU mission training Mali's military and in another mission training Mali's police. So they're very heavily involved in this area. And you look at what German generals and military leaders have been saying for quite some time. They have singled out this strategy of using Mali as an important base. You know, they recognize the importance of North Africa for all of Europe, and France does as well. They see Europe gets a huge amount of its oil, for example, from Algeria, that's just across the ways there. Mm-hmm. You look at the migrant crisis and the way that just rocks Europe politically, and instability in North Africa very quickly becomes people getting in small boats and coming across into Europe. And so they're very directly connected to any kind of chaos in this area. There's other resources in this area that Europe gets and benefits from. And because there's no really good natural borders, it's very easy for these terrorists to move through the kind of Southern Sahara area from one country to another. So if you have one country like Mali collapses, then terrorists can set up there, they can use that as a base, And suddenly that Mali's not the only one that's struggling. All of these surrounding countries get hit and have problems. So Germany's identified this, and they've talked about using Mali as a key military base. And this, I think, is why they've built this up as their number one overseas destination of troops. They had a Colonel Hainish, one of their kind of writing a paper talking about how Mali plays a crucial role as a source of conflict and a hub of refugee routes to Europe. And then he talked about how the then German defense minister, writing a few years ago, Ursula von der Leyen, sees Africa as the future focus of German military commitments. And then the Christian Democratic Union's military expert, Roderick Kesselwetter, he said that he talked about a major operation that cannot be limited to Mali. It's important that we think in the longer terms, we think in terms of Libya. So they've been saying we need to get involved in Mali and build up a base here, because there's other countries in North Africa that we need to get involved in and that we need to be thinking in terms of Libya as well. Mm-hmm. So Mali is a very important center for the German military to establish itself in so that it can project its power throughout the region.
Now, for this coup to have taken place, it seems like the European response is essentially that this complicates those plans. There are a lot of people looking at this and saying this opens the door for greater problems, greater jihadist problems. They could take advantage of the unrest that's taking place there, which kind of is what happened the last time this took place. There was a coup, what, 8-9 years ago there that created the kind of problems that we're seeing to this day. So does this cause Europe to say we need to invest even more heavily in this nation to prevent that from happening? They certainly are denouncing this coup. What is your view?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Everybody knows that history, and they know where this led in the past. I haven't seen any concrete plans for more intervention from Europe. One of the things that European powers have been doing is building up and training local militaries to work with. So they've created things like a group of six nations in the Sahel area, where they've got permission for this military to a combined military with all of them to travel across borders and go into other countries and deal with problems there. So they've got kind of their own European proxy force made up of local Africans. And I think they're doing a lot to try and encourage the other African countries in the region to get involved. So I think Europe has got to be worried. I haven't seen any evidence of them doing too much about that yet. It might be because they're perhaps more worried about what's going on in Belarus right now, which we'll hear a bit about later. I think that's been taking up a lot of the mental bandwidth of European leaders. But we'll definitely have to wait and see. I think there is a sense that maybe this is going to be okay as well. You know, yes, last time there was a coup, it provided an opening for Islamists. But if we don't overreact and if we manage this carefully, maybe we could just keep going as normal and have a peaceful transition of power. And maybe this will make things better by ending some of these protests and things like that. So, I haven't seen much concrete moves yet.
So just to look at this in the context of prophecy and Europe's overall strategy for its presence there in North Africa, you alluded to it, but we're looking at prophecies with this conflict between this Islamist force and a European force. Mali could factor into that in some ways. Certainly its presence in Northern Africa could factor in. Where would you direct people to better understand why it's important to watch what Europe is doing here?
Yeah, we had a couple of really landmark articles from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry right when when Mali kind of first exploded. So he had one called Watch Algeria, and that article begins, Northern Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. And he talked about how Iran is sponsoring a lot of the terrorist activity that you see in Northern Africa. And he talked about, well, though Iran is not the only power interested, he said Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. They will inevitably clash with each other. And in that article, he even went and talked about Mali, and he talked about how terrorists are taking over Mali. And in, basically right after saying that, he said, Germany has great power in Africa, even military power, that few people are paying attention to. Germany is not about to give that power up, certainly without a fight. And then he talks about the way that France got involved in Mali to beat that back, that they were probably being encouraged by Germany in doing that. So this was before Germany started building up this military base, and Mr. Flory was drawing attention to Germany's role in North Africa. And then shortly after that, he had another article called The Whirlwind Prophecy. And what this article does is talk about just some a very specific prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, where it talks about Daniel chapter 11 talks about this clash, and it's this clash that informed the Watch Algeria article that Mr. Flory wrote, that you're having a clash between a power called the King of the South and a power called the King of the North. And you know, we have more about this in our book, The King of the South, but the King of the South is referring to radical Islam led by Iran, and it's going to clash with the King of the North, this European power led by Germany. And it says that the King of the North, this European power, is going to come against Iran like a whirlwind. And you look at what the Hebrew word for that word whirlwind means, and it carries connotations of surrounding, attacking from all directions. So yes, the intensity of a whirlwind, but also just this idea of being surrounded. And he said, well, you can look at what that verse means, and it's talking about Germany enacting a strategy right now to surround Iran and radical Islam, establishing bases all around these potential hotspots. Then you look at what these German military experts and military policy setters said just in the months after that article came out, and they were talking about establishing bases around these areas of radical Muslim outgrowth and talking about Mali being a key center in this combat against radical Islam. Some of the languages that they used was even very similar to the whirlwind. One talks about there being this ring of fire in terms of all of these terrorist groups and Germany needing to establish bases all around this ring of fire. A very similar language to the whirlwind prophecy. So you've got this one word written 2,000 or 3,000 years ago giving us very specific information about Germany's current military policy. And that's going to be critical in watching what happens in Mali. You know, Germany is building up a base there. They're planning to confront Iran. They're confronting radical Islam. That's going to inform their response from here on out. So those two articles, just really landmark pieces, are fantastic for understanding what's happening here. That's Watch Algeria and the Whirlwind Prophecy. And then just if you want to learn more about the overall context of the Middle East, of course, that book I mentioned, The King of the South, as well, is just essential to understand what's happening in that part of the world.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Well, criticizing Vladimir Putin can be very hazardous to your health. This has been the case with many of his most outspoken critics, and now a leading opposition figure is in the hospital fighting for his life. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, if you tune into most mainstream news in Russia right now, you'll hear that Alexei Navalny is in the hospital because he had a night of extremely heavy drinking and poisoned himself with too much alcohol. That's the narrative that's being pushed by a lot of Russian media, Russia Today, RIA, Novosti, Interfax even. But the truth about this situation is actually quite different and quite a lot more sinister than that. Navalny is 44 years old. He's a lawyer and an anti-corruption activist, and he's well known as being Vladimir Putin's fiercest critic. He's really viewed as Putin's number one domestic opponent, and he has been arrested numerous times and served stints in jail for trumped-up charges of all kinds. And the real purpose behind these arrests is always well understood to be his anti-Putin political activity. The European Court of Human Rights even categorized Navalny during one of his recent jail stints as a political prisoner, just because he had been denied a fair trial. And then back in 2012, the Wall Street Journal described Navalny as, quote, the man Vladimir Putin fears most. So this is a man that's been just a thorn in Vladimir Putin's flesh for many years now. And it really looks like this time, Putin may have decided that arresting and imprisoning Navalny was not enough anymore. So what happened yesterday is Navalny was en route. He was actually in the air when he began feeling ill. He was en route from Siberia to Moscow. And the illness hit him very fast, very hard. He lost consciousness on the plane. The plane had to be emergency landed. He was rushed into a hospital in the city of Omsk. And doctors there ever since have been doing everything they can to help him. But he is in a coma. He's on a ventilator and just fighting for his life, as you said. Not all the details are known about this yet, but his spokesperson did release a statement saying, quote, "Whether or not Putin gave the order personally, the blame lies with him." So, you know, that's a chilling possibility. And it's a possibility that if you know anything about the history of right. Vladimir Putin, sounds not at all unlikely.
Well, yeah. Talk about why this type of thing that you immediately begin to suspect official channels being the cause.
Yeah, well, Putin truly does have a disturbing history of using violence against his enemies. The Trumpet.com's managing editor, Mr. Brad McDonald, cataloged many of these, the most atrocious of these incidents, in an article from back in 2014. And in one section of that, he writes, quote, "Putin's conduct inside Russia is alarming and repulsive. Since he became president, 40 journalists have been murdered. He's destroyed private business and enterprise, crushed independent media outlets, brought Russia's energy under almost total government control, and walked all over Russia's constitution." End quote. So that was from back in 2014, and now we could update that. Instead of 40 journalists, we know that it's more than 130 that have been killed under Putin's watch. And we could also update the part about Putin walking all over the Constitution. Now he has officially rewritten it. He's not just been bending and breaking it. Earlier this year, he actually rewrote it. And then we also know that Putin has a history specifically with poisoning. In 2004, it became clear that he was responsible for the poisoning of Ukraine's opposition leader, Viktor Yushchenko. Yushchenko was running against a man that was essentially Putin's puppet in Ukraine. So Putin had him poisoned. He did survive, but he has lifetime health complications ever since then. And then 2 years after that, evidence shows that Putin had a dissenter named Alexander Litvinenko poisoned. And this time the poison was polonium-210. You know, that's not something that anyone can just get. It's like Putin wanted people to know this was a state-sanctioned poisoning, and it was a lethal dose. The poor man sat on a hospital bed for 2 weeks as his body just broke apart, and he died. And then there was also a former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter. That was in 2018, that they were poisoned with a nerve agent in England. And we talked about that on a couple of Trumpet Hour episodes at that time. And the list of these kinds of murders with Putin's fingerprints all over them just goes on and on. So if it is proven that Putin was behind this week's poisoning of Alexei Navalny, as Navalny's spokesperson and many other people say is the case, then it would fit into a well-established and very disturbing pattern.
And, of course, Vladimir Putin is a personality that we watch very closely because of our editor-in-chief drawing attention to prophecies that point directly to him.
That's right, yes. Ezekiel 38 is the big one that we go to. That chapter describes a lot of events that are occurring right now, even though it was written more than 2,000 years ago. The passage describes an extremely powerful man that would rise up and lead not just Russia, but also exert a lot of influence in Russia's periphery. And the chapter gives some chilling details about just how much devastation this man will soon author. And it calls him, if it's correctly translated, the Prince of Russia. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has, since 2013, identified Vladimir Putin as this Prince of Russia. So we know that Putin is fulfilling this tremendously important prophetic role. And because of that, we shouldn't really be surprised to see him resorting to violence to keep himself in power and, you know, poisoning his enemies so that he can remove threats and just tighten his grip on Russia. And then there's actually another important detail about Ezekiel 38 that we don't talk about as often. And that is that there are actually two personalities discussed here. One is the Prince of Russia that signifies Vladimir Putin, and the other one is called the Son of Man, who is called on to deliver God's message about the Prince of Russia. So there's a lot packed into this chapter, and it's clear that God not only reveals the identity of the Prince of Russia to this messenger individual, But he also commands the messenger to set his face against him and to prophesy against him. So God really is using this messenger to warn the world about the Prince of Russia and just how dangerous he is, both inside of Russia, as we saw this week with this poisoning, and outside of Russia, as we see more and more in the periphery of Russia. And we'll even touch on some of that later in the show. But Mr. Fleury has a hard-hitting booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, which makes very plain who these two individuals are. And I would just highly recommend that to anyone who hasn't read it.
We will link to that in the show notes, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Jeremiah is also working on an article about this latest incident with Putin's main opposition leader. And you can watch for that on thetrumpet.com, as well as that article by Brad McDonald that describes some of Putin's activities 6 years ago, Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Sochi. All just check those out on the show notes for the program today. And thank you for that, Jeremiah. Last week, the United Arab Emirates forged a landmark peace deal with Israel, mediated by the United States. This week, President Donald Trump said he was open to the possibility of selling the Emirates some top-of-the-line advanced fighter jets. Benjamin Netanyahu says he doesn't like the idea. But to learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it didn't take long to find out that there was more to perhaps this deal between the United States, Israel, and the UAE. That, again, as you said, happened last week, which was a normalization of ties between Israel and an Arab state, a really big deal. But came out and it was first leaked to an Israeli paper, Ynet or Yehudanot Aharonot, this week, that Israel had tacitly agreed to the selling of F-35s to UAE to get the deal. Now, that is something that has been heavily discredited by the prime minister. He says that arms with the UAE had absolutely nothing to do with it. They weren't included in the text of the deal. And so we definitely can't report that that was the case. However, the circumstances and just the timing behind this announcement from a UAE official saying that they're interested in them, and then President Trump coming out and saying that we are looking into this matter. We are seeing whether and weighing our options of whether to sell the F-35, which is the premier jet that the United States has, to the UAE. And this is what President Trump said about this. He said it's they have the money and they would like to order quite a few F-35s. It's the greatest fighter jet in the world, as you know, by stealth, totally stealth. They'd like to buy F-35s. We'll see what happens. It's under review, but they made a great advance in peace in the Middle East. And so it is interesting because it looks like the president there is linking them to. If it wasn't part of the agreement, at least he is taking the fact that they're willing to have peace with Israel as a sign that maybe they also deserve the top-of-the-line jet that the United States has.
Why would Israel be opposed?
Well, Israel has always maintained, and the United States has maintained, that Israel should have military superiority over any other Middle Eastern nation. And that is to ensure that if someone attacks Israel, that they would have the hardware and the technological edge to fight back, since they are the tiniest nation there in the Middle East, or one of them, and have faced Arab armies repeatedly through history. And as the chief ally of Israel, the United States, this has been their policy. And the United States have said, even with this announcement, that they are committed to that. However, the F-35 is the crowning achievement of the United States. Israel just had to live this delivered to them, I guess, a year ago. They've got about 20 jets, is another dozen or so on order from the United States. Israel has used them over the past 6 months for the first time inside Syria. And so Israel is understandably worried that they would be facing off potentially in some far off place, because of this deal with the UAE, against similar military hardware. And this is dangerous for Israel's future. But it's something that the United States under President Trump seems very open to.
Now, just knowing what we know about Bible prophecy, we talked about this last week when we were discussing the UAE-Israel deal. This gives us an idea of where this may be headed. Are we looking at, say, if the United States does end up going through with this deal, some of exactly what we were talking about with the dangers in a deal like this and how it does empower these nations that don't necessarily have Israel's best interest at heart. There's a certain trust there established, a relationship that ends up biting Israel in the end.
Yeah, I think it could be that, especially the United States could go to Israel and say, the UAE has never attacked you in war. They are on the forefront of the fight against Iran, as you are. And if you're going to stay in the Middle East without these enemies, you might have to have some trust in some if you're going to stay in the Middle East with all these nations, you're going to have some trust with some of the Arab states. And this is one that looks to be the best in terms of its relationship with you. The United States wants to get out. And so it sees arming the UAE as a counter to Iran and a relationship between Israel and UAE as a way that the U.S. could exit while the U.S. alliance is still strong. And so from all those that standpoint, it makes sense. But as we brought out last week, biblical prophecy indicates that it's not going to be Iran that takes out Israel. It is going to be another alliance, an alliance of nations that the UAE is part of. And so if you see the United Arab Emirates, although they might not have in their mind right now that they're going to use the F-35 on Israel, I don't think that's their goal at getting that. Their goal probably is to counter Iran, to counter probably Turkey's rise as well. But in the end, the Bible says that the UAE will be part of an alliance that is going to attack against Israel. And in this situation with the sale of fighter jets, perhaps the United States is actually arming the UAE for that battle.
Well, we've just finished the production on the October 2020 Trumpet Edition, and Brent has an article in there about the accords between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. He has a version of that he published last week on the website. It's called Trump Abraham Accords Announces Peace Between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. You can check that out, but stick around for the article that will appear as we publish the October 2020 edition of The Trumpet online next week. It puts all of this in context, and that prophecy in Psalm 83 that he was referring to is one that we really do need to understand in order to make sense of what's happening here and the danger in the deal that's being discussed with the United States. Thank you for that, Brent. To American politics now. It is official. After the Democratic Party held its national convention this week, Joe Biden is their candidate. For some analysis of what we saw, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, to those who like listening to that sort of thing, there's definitely, we've heard from a lot of people at the Democratic National Convention this week. We've heard from now Democrat presidential nominee Joe Biden and his wife Jill Biden. We've heard from former President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary Clinton. We've heard from former U.S. President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle Obama. And all these figures have been delivering a consistent message. President Trump is a threat to democracy, therefore vote for Joe Biden like your lives depended on it. Although, like I said, if you listen closely, you'll notice that all of these speeches also have something else in common, is that they're big on drama and short on details. You definitely make the statement that President Donald Trump is a threat to democracy as if it were common knowledge, but you never get into much of the details as to how or why he's a threat to democracy or what specifically they are planning to do to allegedly fix this.
It was amazing to me how many of their pronouncements kind of resurrected these tropes and kind of put the worst possible spin on them, that many of which have been discredited. And even President Obama, Michelle Obama, Kamala Harris, they were willing to just throw out these incendiary lies against Donald Trump that you would think that anyone who is interested in facts at all, that they would recognize that there was they're not true. What they're saying just simply
right.
Isn't true.
Yeah, this is the conservative economic analyst Thomas Sowell. I'm I don't have the exact quote with me because I just thought of it now, but he did say something to that effect some years back, that Barack Obama in particular has a talent for making basically untrue things seem true to those who haven't been following the issues. That's a paraphrase of his quote, but it's basically what you're seeing this week is you can just make the statement that President Trump is a threat to democracy, repeat it often enough, and then expect that people are going to believe you without having to bother into the details of how that is, or even address the allegations of, like I said, many of these things that they've brought up that have been debunked. Really, this week, it was at the very first night of the convention on Monday where we really heard, in my opinion, the only speech that got into some details, not so much about President Trump, but about, like, well, how are Democrats going to change things? And that came from the self-avowed socialist candidate, Bernie Sanders, where he got in there and he definitely use the Donald Trump as a threat to democracy line as well. But then he got into some more details, like, but if you vote for Joe Biden, we're going to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We're going to shut down all fossil fuel powered electricity in 15 years. We're going to expand free health care to everybody. We're going to abolish all private prisons. And a bunch of other promises that no one can keep unless you completely nationalize the healthcare industry, the prison industry, the energy industry, and a bunch of other industries, which is what you'd expect from someone who's a self-avowed socialist. And he's like, well, we just need to nationalize these things. But it does, I think he did really put an important spotlight on exactly what the Democratic Party is taking us, because if you remember back in the primaries, it's like that's kind of the reason the DNC decided not to support Bernie Sanders, is that they thought he sounded too radical, and apparently that was exactly it. He sounded too radical, because they've taken, with the exception of the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, they've taken all his pretty much his entire presidential platform and just handed it to Joe Biden. The Wall Street Journal is even calling, there's a 110-page document outlining the Democrats' platform, which is the Wall Street Journal is calling the Biden-Sanders manifesto. And this is what they had to say about it on August 17th. So on the day Bernie Sanders gave his speech, the Wall Street Journal said, the Biden-Sanders manifesto is the most radical policy document of either major party in our lifetimes. It leaps to the left of the Obama administration on nearly every political area, from education to taxes to climate change. The socialist of the Cold War saw inequality as largely economic. The new left sees inequality as a result of racism, sexism, and other institutional biases. Mr. Sanders, at age 78, may be having his last campaign hurrah, but he is serving as a transitional figure to the new socialist generation who will redistribute income and wealth, regulate business, and micromanage American social arrangements based on ethnicity and gender.
You have to wonder how many Americans are really going to be for this. I think Stephen Fleury has been bringing this out somewhat on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, that the fact that they're lurching this far to the left rather than trying to appeal to the center, it seems like the people who are for all of these things, in some ways, they're certainly not going to vote for Donald Trump. You would think that the Democrats would consider them as, you know, the closest thing to a sure bet that you could have, that they would be going after the center. But it seems like it's almost like they can't help themselves but embrace these radical policies that the Democratic Party is never going to be what it was in the past, and in some ways it's kind of drawing the nation into this kind of confrontation between those who are more centrist and those who are just so radical.
Right. Yeah. President Trump said that Joe Biden was a Trojan horse for socialism, and then I kind of looked at the DNC and was like, shrug your shoulders, like, where's the where's the horse?
Yeah. It's, yeah. Like, it's just Trojans
see,
coming in.
I just need to see like a court of socialist Greeks coming for a bailout, but it's but yeah, what you're, the point you just made though is that I don't know if they're doing this wittingly or not, but you're like, you're right. Like if you wanted to win the election, you'd go towards the center. If you're going this far left, it's almost like it's like premeditated division in America, and that's largely why we're watching this on this program. Is there's many prophecies we watch in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 and Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 about civil war in America. Isaiah 1 and verse 7 talking about cities burning with fire. Ezekiel 5 talking about a death toll in the millions that comes from this civil war. And you don't get a civil war when everyone unites around the center. You get a civil war when everyone gravitates towards the poles. Mm-hmm. I guess on the Republican side, President Trump's platform is, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, is pretty center. But as even the Wall Street Journal said, this Biden-Sanders manifesto is the most radically left document in American history. Mm-hmm. And this is like, if you can't win the election, then you either give up or you start fighting.
Right.
The Bible prophecies definitely shows that the fight, it's not going to be a negotiated slide towards socialism like it has been for the past several years. It's actually going to be a violent fight over two completely different ideologies. I have an article on the website right now entitled Bernie Sanders Delivers Blueprint for a Biden Presidency, which goes through some of the details I've just been talking about. But at the end, it points people to the third chapter of Mr. Gerald Fleury's America Under Attack booklet, An Attack on Law. And I think that especially, the whole booklet is vital reading, but that third chapter is the one that really gets into what the Bible says about like socialism and communism and civil war in end time America.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Protests in Belarus against the ruling authoritarian president don't seem to be letting up at all. We're watching for how this may open the door for Russia to intervene and extend its influence in this former Soviet nation. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we spoke about this situation last week with the longtime strongman in Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, having rigged an election on August 9th so that he could stay in power and continue his 26-year reign. And we spoke about how the people were protesting against his corruption and against this ridiculous landslide victory that he awarded to himself. And those protests, as you said, have not died down. This week, they continued with hundreds of thousands of people from across the country taking part. And the European Union even came out on Wednesday and said it does not recognize the results of the election. EU representatives said they even plan to impose sanctions on individuals responsible for violence and repression and election fraud. So we'll see if any of that rhetoric from the EU ends up going beyond words. But it does show that the world is taking notice of this situation in Belarus. And one other really notable development from this week has been nationwide strikes. Thousands of Belarusians are walking off their jobs to join the demonstrators, and there have been organized strikes from many workers of state-run factories and even the media, which is essentially a propaganda circuit in Belarus. So many of the people are hoping that by shutting sectors of the economy down with strikes, they can increase the pressure on Lukashenko and on those who are protecting him, and eventually convince him to step down.
Now, that's been kind of a dangerous thing to do in Belarus for a long time, and essentially they're saying there's so much at stake, it's worth taking the risk.
It looks like it, yes. It's a dangerous place to protest because it is a dictatorship, and the police are not afraid to use force to try to suppress the protests. There is also a fascinating development. You mentioned Putin and his eye that he has on Belarus. And with the media strikes, there were hundreds of people who are, you know, presenters on news shows, people who write articles and hold microphones and cameras. And since it's state-controlled media, their job, as I mentioned, is basically propaganda, to say how virtuous and noble Lukashenko is and how much evidence there is that this election was free and fair. And these people know that what they're creating, these stories that they're creating, are lies. So many of them have been protesting, they've been striking, walking off the job, and they thought that they may be able to get Lukashenko's attention. But that's when Lukashenko's benefactor, his number one ally, stepped in. Vladimir Putin, of course. Russia and Belarus are each other's closest allies. The two leaders have a very close personal relationship, even though it's sometimes rocky. But Putin actually flew in a couple of airplanes full of Russians, Russian reporters and other media workers, to replace the Belarusian journalists who went on strike. So that way the news could continue. All the stories about how wonderful Lukashenko and Putin are could keep on saturating the airwaves there. So Putin is supporting Lukashenko. He has said that the election was valid, and he's apparently even promised to send military assistance into Belarus if Lukashenko asks for it. So we'll see what happens there. But it was just a very sad day for the protesters when they saw Putin sweep in and just kind of undermine this important aspect of the strike and the demonstrations.
That was exactly what you had said last week was likely to be an outcome of what we're seeing in Belarus, and prophecy informs that.
Yes. Yeah, we very well could see Putin spin this somehow to increase his control over Belarus, or to at least maintain the status quo. I think he's okay with the status quo as it is, but in the first half, we spoke about how disturbing Putin's rule inside of Russia is. You know, with the poisoning that's just happened there. We spoke about Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, which places all of that in the prophetic context. And that booklet actually talks even more about Putin's power beyond Russia's borders and about how he has been working to just rebuild the geography, really, of the Soviet Union and just recreate that model when so many nations were brought under Russian power. And in Belarus, we see Putin continuing that. You know, as long as Lukashenko stays in power, Belarus is essentially a vassal of Russia. He's okay with that. But another leader, such as the woman who actually won this election, that would be a wild card. There'd be a big question mark hanging over her head about whether she would continue to keep Belarus loyal to Putin, or about whether she might bring it closer to Europe. And so that's why Putin really wants to do whatever it takes to keep Lukashenko in power. So, yeah, I would just plug Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, once again, because it really does help anyone who wants to understand what's happening with these kinds of developments, just see them in the big picture context.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Last week, the United Nations decided to allow an arms embargo against Iran to be lifted. We talked about this on Trumpet Hour. This week, the United States responded by deciding to reimpose much stricter sanctions by itself. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
So this was the showdown at the UN last week, where everyone bar one other nation, including everyone on the Security Council bar the United States, decided to let the arms embargo against Iran to expire. This is one of the first thing from the Iran nuclear deal that Iran was to get, one of those sunset clauses that would happen after 5 years, which would expire on October 30. And Russia, China, UK, France, Germany, they all said, that's fine. That's fine. Let Iran, the chief sponsor of terrorism around the world, let them get submarines, let them get our jets, let them get our weaponry. We want to sell it to them. The United States said, okay, fine. We've got another route to try and stop Iran from getting those weapons, and that is to announce the snapback of sanctions that were lifted on Iran at the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal. So these sanctions are they go further than just the arms embargo being lifted or how stopping nations from doing that. It is actually going to announce that anyone that sells those arms to Iran in the future, such as Russia or China, if they decide to sell those arms to Iran past October 30th, that the United States is then going to sanction those massive organizations. And the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was not shy about that. He said in an interview on Fox to Bret Baier that if Russia and China do sell arms, yes, definitely, 100%, they will be sanctioned by the United States. And so, just looking at this picture, it's kind of bizarre that you have the Security Council of the United Nations that it has come together to say we want Iran to have access to conventional military equipment. And we are going to do all we can to make sure that that happens. And one nation, the United States standing up saying, no, you don't. That's dangerous for everybody. It's dangerous for everyone in the Middle East. 2 weeks ago, all the nations in the Middle East, all the Gulf states, including Israel and then Egypt, they wrote a letter to the Security Council saying, don't you dare let the arms embargo expire. This is going to be a catastrophe for the Middle East. And the Security Council by the United States let it expire.
Mike Pompeo said that he actually talked to other nations that didn't want this to happen as well. They didn't want Iran to be able to receive the arms, but they didn't have the courage to actually stand up and stand behind their principles, the United States being the only one. What do you make of this, Brent? Where would the nation, where would we be, where would the world be without the United States leadership right now? And how much longer is this going to last?
Yeah, it is very strong proof that the leadership of President Trump has prevented war in the Middle East because of what Iran was going to get through the Iran nuclear deal. They would have, let's go to October 30th this year when the arms embargo expires per the nuclear deal, they would have $230 more billion dollars had the United States stayed in the nuclear deal. That's a lot of money to go and buy whatever arms they want from the likes of Russia and China. They want the arms embargo to end, not just because they don't like the United States, but because they want to sell all that they have to Iran. They want the business deal to come from that. And yet President Trump, rightly so, campaigned on how evil this deal was and saw it as Iran gets everything, Israel, a little nation in the Middle East, gets nothing, and perhaps even it gets wiped off the face of the earth because of this deal. Remember, the United States was sold this deal by President Obama, by John Kerry, and by Biden, presidential nominee Biden. They were sold this deal that if Iran doesn't comply with the nuclear deal, snap back. We can snap back all the sanctions that were lifted. They each have said that. And everyone knows, including Russia, China, UK, Germany, France, that Iran has not complied by the nuclear deal. And yet none of them have the guts or the willingness to snap back the sanctions. The United States has come along and said, we're going to do that. And so, yes, this is a clear sign that the United States and the leadership, specifically of one man, President Trump, stands between the Ayatollahs getting all the weapons that they would want, stands between that happening and not happening. And that is just really strong proof for an article that was written by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, in the latest Trumpet, well, the one that has been up for a month or so. His article, The Barack Obama Mystery, talks about how the nuclear deal by the Obama administration was actually deliberately set up to empower Iran, and that it was, and that President Obama and those with him were fine with the fruits of that deal, setting up Iran, empowering that Iran, and then also the what would we waged upon Israel. And yet President Trump has come along, and this is not to glorify a man, because as Mr. Flory brings out in that article, God has raised up President Trump to save both the United States and also the state of Israel, it seems, temporarily. And that was prophesied anciently in the Bible, and we see a direct fruit of that, or a direct proof of that, in this deal with the sanctions on Iran.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent. Israel and Germany have a horrific history looking back to the Holocaust. But in recent years, the trust between these two nations has grown dramatically. The most recent example of this is flying over German skies this week. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Israeli pilots were training in German airspace for the first time ever. Now, these two forces have flown together in the past, but this was deemed as an especially symbolic event where they weren't just flying together anyway. They were coming back to Germany, and it was an event that had lots of symbols surrounding the Holocaust and Germany kind of apologizing for the Holocaust, showing how much they value Israel, how much they value the Jews. There was a lot of high-level meetings. One officer quoted by the agency France Presse characterized the welcoming ceremony for the incoming Israeli pilots as the warmest hug one can give. And, you know, just a lot of heavy symbols throughout this event. Now, the reason why this is so significant is, just like Brent talked about in the first half, there's a lot of very specific Bible prophecies about Israel and about a peace being used to actually harm and betray Israel. And Brent was talking about it with regard to the United Arab Emirates. But you know, you can look at Daniel chapter 8 as a scripture that is very specifically for the end time. It talks about an individual who is who stands up against Jesus Christ himself. So very specifically an end time prophecy. And it says that this individual, well, he destroys many. You know, peace is a weapon that is used against Israel in the Middle East and other descendants of ancient Israel. And so, you know, we have those prophecies. And now you're seeing Germany, that has a history of not being Israel's best friend, and really all of Europe has a history of anti-Semitism that goes back centuries. There are important reasons then to ask, well, we've got these prophecies saying that they use peace to destroy Israel. Is this genuine? Are there going to be some problems coming from that? And the Bible definitely says yes. A great place to go to learn more about this is Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flowey's book, Jerusalem in Prophecy. And you know, that scripture in Daniel chapter 8 is just one of a great many of scriptures that talk about a fraudulent peace process, Europe using peace deceitfully in their relationship with Israel, and Israel being betrayed by Europe. And so that book is a great place to go to learn all of the details of this Bible prophecy.
Okay, thank you. Our last story today, California is suffering a cluster of curses right now. To learn about it, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, when you look at California this week, it does just beggar the question, how many things can go wrong at once? On Wednesday, millions of Californians were smothered in smoke as 23 wildfires raged out of control across the state. The state braced for triple-digit temperatures, with it hitting 130 degrees Fahrenheit in Death Valley. These high temperatures have prompted people to really crank up their air conditioning to keep their body temperatures regulated. But since the state's relying so much on green energy, which is not very robust to spikes in demand, they've overloaded their power grid, and the state's facing rolling blackouts for the first time in two decades. And then just to top all that off, the coronavirus is still allegedly killing 134 Californians a day. So definitely a plethora of many curses that would take a long time to unpack, but the wildfires in particular are something that we talk a lot about on this program. California has been plagued by wildfires for each year since the early 90s. You almost just think that's California's climate now, but it's not. It hasn't been throughout California's history. It's really been in the past couple decades that they've really had a serious problem with this. And yeah, in the show notes, we can we'll put our trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Increase Natural Disasters, that goes through prophecies in Leviticus 26, verses 3 through 4, and 2 Chronicles 7, verses 13 through 14, and others that give ironclad promises from God that if a nation obeys him, they will get rain in due season, which some rain in this season is something Californians probably could really use right now.
Yeah, we'll link to that trend article, and also just the fact that this is taking place in California specifically is something that our editor-in-chief has talked about quite a bit. We'll link to his article, Is California Under a Curse, for information about that. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to these gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brenton Octagall. Thank you to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Paine. To argue with a person who has renounced the use of reason is like administering medicine to the dead. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.